Katrina Mewburn, a professor at the Australian National University and editor of the Thesis Whisperer blog. Welcome to Academics Talk About the Chair. This podcast is a lockdown project because, well, why not? Australia is having the pandemic we had to have, according to certain politicians anyway, and we're all stuck in our own homes. I'm so bored, I actually made a TikTok account. And other things we've been doing during lockdown is watching a lot of Netflix. In particular, we've been watching the new Netflix series called The Chair. One of the only shows to ever depict contemporary academic life on the small screen. But what do academics think of The Chair? We are four white female academics and we loved it. And we want to tell you all our thoughts and feelings about the series. We'll do a recap, complete with spoilers, but you can skip it if you want to. Then we'll talk about what's real, what's not, who had the best line, and importantly, the outfits. But first, some introductions.
Hi, I'm Narelle Lemon, and I'm an Associate Professor in Education at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. I'm an interdisciplinary scholar across arts, education, and positive psychology, and I blog and write about wellbeing and self-care at exploreandcreateco.com. And I subscribe to Netflix to watch The Chair.
Hi, I'm Megan McPherson, and I'm a precariously employed artist researcher and educator in art and intercultural research, and I work at the University of Melbourne.
Hi, I'm Anitra. I'm ex-co-chair of a school of graphic design at an art and design university in San Francisco, and now I'm professional staff at RMIT Online, where I'm head of course design. I also sound exactly like Inga. I also look a lot like Inga. And yes, we did switch classrooms once to try and fool our teachers, but neglected to brief each other on where each other sat in the classroom. So we were discovered very, very quickly and never tried it again.
Yeah. I mean, that's the lots of twin myths that we could bust.
So many.
So many. As you can tell, none of us are film studies academics, so don't expect a deep, informed analysis grounded in literature. But wait, guess what? For a second week in a row, we have a fandom scholar expert to join us. Dr. Bertha Chin, a senior lecturer from Swinburne University of Technology in Sarawak, Malaysia, Borneo. Bertha, say hello.
Hi, everyone, and it's good to be back. And I'm here to provide the X-Files geekery, especially for this episode. And as I mentioned last week, for those of you who didn't know, one of my inspirations for going into a PhD program is actually because of Duchovny and the X-Files.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us again, Bertha. Your specialist expertise will be much needed on this episode because in Academics Talk About the Chair, we're taking our cue from projects like Doctors Watch Grey's Anatomy. We're comparing our experience and knowledge of how a profession works with a fictional account on the screen. As I said, we're three white female academics located in Australia, plus one woman of colour located in Malaysia, and we've done various jobs inside academia. But of course, we can't claim to have experienced everything. So this is our point of view. We want to hear others, and you can write to us. We'll include your ideas and opinions in our correspondence section at the end. But first, let's go straight to our episode recap. This week, Megan is doing the honours. Take it away, Megan.
This week we're talking about episode 5, which is The Last Bus in Town. The opening shot is Ji-Yu sitting in front of the dean and Ronnie, Mr. Reputational Management, with the dean asking if at any point she threatened Bill's TA. Lila doesn't have a name with the dean. Ji-Yu looks shocked and tries to justify. She mentioned that the department could get hurt from Bill's Nazi situation. This Ji-Yoon issue could be another brilliant mistake from the first episode. The local paper, Pembroke Daily, is running an article stating that Ji-Yoon issued a gag order. The dean goes on to ask if Ji-Yoon had a discussion with Bill's TA, still with no name, about the incident. Ji-Yoon declares that it was certainly not what she meant to convey. The dean goes on about the mobilising students and their concern and asking for Ji-Yoon to make a statement. Ronnie handily has a draft ready to go that places Bill's employment into the fire. There's no co-writing here. It's all Bill's fault. Tenure is not a blank check anymore, particularly in this climate. And then all of Bill's dirty washing comes out. Lecturing when hungover, nude photos in class, the video of his wife in labour, getting rides from female students. That happened once, Ji-Yoon responds. Which one? Asks the dean. Ji-Yoon replies, all of them. the co-ed in the car comes up. And this is where I get a bit disappointed in Ji Yoon saying, "Did she complain?" The dean and Ronnie make noises. Title IX type responses. She shouldn't have to. The dean asks if Ji Yoon and Bill are involved. And Ji Yoon's response, "If I was a man, would you ask me that?" This discussion goes into referencing Ji Yoon's responsibility, policy, and it finishes with Ji Yoon signing the papers to start pushing Bill into the fire of unemployment and a decoupling from academia. As Ji Yoon leaves the office, she's leaving a message on Bill's phone, "Call me, we need to talk." In her hand, Ji Yoon has the fire letter that she signed with the dean. Ji Yoon might be toast here. Bill is toast. We cut to Bill, earphones on, listening to punk music, laying on the couch with the crumpled mess around him to match his attire. Juju and Ji Yoon stop in her car, Juju exclaiming that she has to see Bill. Ji Yoon refuses to take her in and pushes the fire envelope under the door. Juju is distressed. She needs to check with Bill about his late wife to prepare for Dies de los Muertos. Juju exclaims that his wife's soul won't know where to go. "You know nothing," and under her breath she mutters, "Buddha." Ji Yoon slowly turns and says the reason why Juju knows Buddha is because Ji Yoon gives her Spanish lessons and this planned summer trip to Mexico. Juju's friend Ava is going to Disneyland, so burn Ji Yoon. And then we cut to Bembo's opening credits. Bill arises from the dead in his remains of beer bottles and pizza boxes and snacks, walks across the hall to see the fire envelope that Ji Yoon slipped under the door. He reads the letter, crumples it up in his hands. The toast is cooked. He goes to the bathroom, picks up a bottle of his late wife's opioid painkillers, and I checked, they are opioid painkillers, takes a few. This is not looking good, middle-aged white man, and some cannabis watermelon fruit juice as a chaser. It's really not looking good, Mr. Toast. Next scene is Ji Yoon and Juju arriving at her dad's. They are early, but Ji Yoon has to go and do something else. Her dad reminds her Minji, the second cousin, has only one first birthday. How many family birthdays has Ji Yoon missed? Many, it seems. Her dad is not happy. They have a discussion re the life-work balance, or as I described it on Twitter recently, life work satisfaction, and promptly had a little encounter with the skin crawl response, because, you know, how's your life balance? It's never a question we like. Ji Yoon and her dad have a heated discussion about Juju not understanding Korean. Ji Yoon reminding her dad that he can speak English and Ji Yoon understands more Korean than he thinks. This indicates that the relationship between Juju and her grandpop is a bit fraught. Juju is mad and silent in response to Ji Yoon telling her that she loves her in Korean. Juju wanted to be working on her Mexican presentation with Bill. She's a cultural ambassador, remember? And at this point, why is Ji Yoon wearing white socks? She's wearing black pants. Does she know nothing about fashion?
She's got a very busy day today, Megan. That's it.
She needed you, yeah. Megan. I mean, you consult on those things. Just saying.
We cut to Mr. Toast walking up the street, half, maybe three quarters high on opioids and watermelon chews. A car drives past and a young man yells out at him and throws a bag at him. Who knows what's in the bag? Car speeds off. Bill takes another couple of pills and Mr. Toast is still not coping well. Ji Yoon's car drives up to a big house and we see her ring the bell on a grand glass and twirly blacksmith metal double door. It's time for a big entrance. But no. Ji Yoon knocks and knocks again and then slowly tries to open the door. It's unlocked. Yelling hello, she enters, calling out, "Mr. Duchovny, we have arrived." Mr. Duchovny has a net worth of $80 million. I checked on Google. Anyways, a big house.
I would have thought it was more than that.
No, I'm shocked by that much. Doesn't he call himself overpaid? He's clearly overpaid. That's all.
Anyways, big house, lots of tasteful pale marble, Ji Yoon in a clumpy boots and a duffel coat. There's the noise of water splashing coming down from below the stairs. Ji Yoon calls, "David," and alights the stair. She arrives in a bar room with a pool with a ceiling like the inside of an upturned wooden boat. A body is doing laps. She enters a room and says, "What the fuck? The fucking fuck." The pool room is quite amazing. The swimming body comes toward Ji-Yoon. "Hey, hi," she yells to get their attention. And who is in the pool? Yes, it's David Duchovny. Mulder, Hank Moody, or Jeremy from Sex and the City. At this point, I have to say that I've never seen The X-Files, and I've seen one episode of Californication, and I can't remember David in the Sex and the City episode. I'm sure he's a good actor and all, and he's worth $80 million, and he's written 4 novels, which is 4 more than me, and Wikipedia says that he earned his Master of Art in English Literature from Yale University and subsequently began work on a PhD that remains unfinished. The title of his uncompleted doctoral thesis is Magic and Technology in Contemporary Fiction and Poetry. So you can just imagine what that's going to be like. And Inga, you'll be pleased to note that he is an enthusiast of electric vehicle technology.
There are many of us who feel enthusiastic, but yes, a disappointment in his favour.
Exactly. Well, you know. Anyway, Ji-Yoon spins around and gets tangled up in a palm. DD asks, and I'm just going to call him DD from now on because Bertha has said this is what the fandom say.
That's if the fandom term is correct. I think
so.
It's,
can we all call him DD?
Acceptable usage.
Can we make a pack now? So none of us has to. All right.
Yeah. If this was a paper, it would be David Duchovny brackets right. DD, and from then on, we'd just say nice. DD. Let's do that.
Yeah. DD asks, "Are you okay?" Ji-Yoon answers, "Sorry, I thought you were naked." DD looks down at his red Speedos and says, "Interesting."
And isn't it, it's one of those moments where every female that, you know, likes men is like, "Oh, hello." He's looking okay. I'm just going to put it out there.
He hasn't got excessive dad bod, but he has not got dad bod, though, I've got to say.
Hey, Bertha and I at the time text when we were watching it going, "Oh, hello, Red Speedo."
I nearly spit coffee over my keyboard. I shouldn't.
Anyway.
I've gone to look for videos of that scene from The X-Files.
Yeah, we're going to need to see those.
There's a scene?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're going to have to, yeah, you're really going to have to give us a backstory on that, Bertha.
Yeah.
It will come up, I'm sure.
We cut to a seedy-looking Bill walking down the street. At this point, I will say, has he not found his car yet? Juju yells out, "Bill, Bill," from the back of her grandfather's car. Bill's on the way to McDonald's. Juju and Grandpa are going to Mi-Jun's birthday party. Bill ends up in the back seat with Juju going to the party. Juju is pleased as punch. Bill asks, "Will there be cake?" We cut to Elliot in the library looking at the microfiche reader. Yaz approaches and hands back the letter from the photocopier from last week's episode. This is where Elliot does his Elliot thing, and he tries to justify his judgment by saying that he was too positive, they wouldn't believe him. This seems just sad. Yaz reacts, drops Ji-Yoon's list of retirees into it, the reason for the merge class. Elliot still doesn't get it. "I don't pander my students. I'm not a salesman." At this point, Yaz drops a line, "You're not a professor either because you don't have any students." At this point, we know she's going. She's leaving the ship. She's burnt that bridge. Elliot then goes to check if John knows anything about the list targeting the dinosaurs. John farts and doesn't know if it's him or Elliot farting. Back to DD and Ji-Yoon. David is telling Ji-Yoon how he's thinking of presenting his Yale dissertation. I can't even say that now. This is a half a ream of paper chapter, so I'm imagining it's a stream of consciousness rubble of words. Ji-Yoon asks if he used really big font. "Oh, type note, Anitra. What are the best fonts for really big rambly half reams of paper chapters? Other than, of course, Times New Roman or Comic Sans."
Well, I've been doing some research for our new pod and I've learned quite a bit more about Times New Roman, or TNR, as I'm now calling it, and it's a lot more interesting than I realised. So I'm just going to resist the urge to talk about hot metal typography. But if you really want to nerd out, you can take a listen. It's called The Type Pod and it'll be out next week, right, Inga? That's if we manage to record it. tomorrow. That's the plan.
Yes, we'll see how you go. It did take us an hour to record three minutes.
It did, but I'm sure it'll be better next time. Anyway, so I was just going to say that many students, just like David, do think they have to use Times New Roman for their thesis, but you don't usually. So you should always check the specs your university provides. And if it doesn't provide any typeface guidance, then you can use whatever you want. So there are many other choices. I myself use Cambria, which is a lovely serif font. You can, of course, use a sans serif if you like. Calibri is nicer than Arial, as I said to somebody on Twitter today, Inga. Always helpful to hand out advice on Twitter about what to use in your thesis. But you should go for a style that your discipline uses. And apparently Baskerville is the most trustworthy typeface, so you can take that as you will. I won't get into Baskerville. You know how I feel about that. Only don't try changing the typeface in your ethics application. I actually got told off of fixing the template and changing the typeface, and I had to resubmit it. So you do have to be careful. And Times New Roman shouldn't be set 12 point. Never set it bigger than 11 point if you're going to print it out. And ironically, G-Uni accuses his thesis of being stuck in the mid-80s in a little bit and remarks on how big the font is. But you do need to set type bigger for the screen, minimum 14 point. So you'll notice, everyone, that I changed this part of the outline set in that size with a little bit more leading in it, and it's a bit easier to read, right? Like,
it is. We should go back and readjust.
Correct. Needs to be bigger for the screen. So maybe David's a little bit ahead of his time. Like, maybe he could still get on board with the digital humanities, potentially.
Possibly.
His thesis is already a little bit ready for that, and thank you for allowing me to nerd on that subject, Megan.
Oh, my pleasure. But back to DD. And he's thinking about filing for his PhD. I did laugh out loud at this point, Dr. David.
I laughed so much at this point. And actually, Mr. Thesis Whisperer laughed with me, and we had to stop it and laugh. And then we played it a bit more and laughed. And then we rewound it and laughed. And I thought, poor Mr. Thesis Whisperer, he's been just listening to me talk about these things for so many years, 17 years now, people, that he... He got all the nuance and all the jokes here because it was very funny. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now, but it was my favourite bit.
This scene is so good and so bad. DD manages to be racist, arrogant and a total prick. Total English lit theory boy behaviour. I just see vibe and aura. And yours is lovely, he sighs and says, I'm going to make a smoothie. And have you been to the farmer's market here? Jiyun starts to read the chapter as DD makes the smoothie. Q, sound a blender. So we cut to Bill, Juju and her grandfather entering the party with gift. It's like a Frankenstein family, a Korean auntie says. And this is where we get the backstory of Juju's adoption. It's actually really well done in this scene, highlighting the differences of experiences of what people have in adoption and what money can do in this space. Bill looks longingly at the cake. He has the munchies. Juju takes him away from the cake table and drags him over to the men's drinking table, where he learns the cultural ways of drinking Korean earmuffs. You certainly can't hear it, children, after a few of these. Back to Ji-Yoon and DD. DD wants a catch-up tutorial. He's only missed 30 years. A lot has happened in the field. Then there's a great back and forth by Ji-Yoon and DD, both insulting each other in ways that really cuts to the quick. The best line is, this reads as though it's stuck in the mid-80s. We cut back to the party where Bill is now toasted with the others. We get a bit more of the backstory of Peter, Ji-Yoon's old boyfriend. The auntie's knitting him a sweater. Lol. They judge Bill as looking messy, and he is. And he looks as though he's fallen asleep, drunk, on one of the other guys' shoulder. We cut back to Ji-Yoon alone on the couch. My God, how long is this taking? Ji-Yoon should be at the party. Where is DD? She hears voices coming from upstairs and goes to look for him. He's singing with a guitar, the only song I've ever heard quote Wallace Stevens. It's called Mind of Winter. It's on the latest DD album. Spotify link is in the show notes.
Oh, thank you, Megan.
He has three albums. I listened. I did not like. DD asks if Pembroke offered the distinguished lectureship to someone else, and Ji-Yoon reels off other celebrity doctorate holders. James Franco, Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke has actually written five novels. Not that I've read any, but five more than
any.
And one more than Dee Dee. Dee Dee has a fabulous idea of teaching just Beckett to replace Bill. Dee responds with teaching is not a pastime and gives Dee Dee a way out. Endow a chair, she says. Give a heap of money. Receive an honorary doctorate. The Dr. David Duchovny chair in English studies. She might be able to save the situation. We cut back to the party. Minji is picking her future role in society by picking a significant object. As Juju explains the significance of the objects, you can see her really connect with her family's culture. And her philosophy of picking the string to live a long life is a really beautiful one. And she's a bit worried about death, this one. As Minji approaches the objects, the crowd starts to cheer and clap. She's looking carefully at all the signifiers. The auntie starts moving the bits and bobs. Kids are like cats and like to play with games. And Bill is affronted with the woman tampering and pushing the money. Let her make her own choice. Bill. She's rigged the process, he gives the paintbrush to Minji and pulls all the attention to himself. It's all about you. Grandfather and his drinking buddy tried to pull him away as he loses his balance. Bill's Class A opioids bottle falls open, scattering pills all around Minji. He's on the floor looking over to Minji as she is hastily picked up as she reaches for one of his pills. We cut to Elliot, Joan and John, the dinosaurs, on a tapestry sofa in a grand wooden panelled room. In this scene, the dinosaurs try and position themselves. They elected Ji-Yoon. She should be grateful. Bill's not on the list. She's in love with him. Joan suggests that they stage a coup. We cut to Ji-Yoon in her car, listening to Dee Dee music. In the office, Ji-Yoon walks in and sees Yaz. Dee Dee is not giving the distinguished lectureship. You are. Yaz has already agreed to give it somewhere else, Yale, and have a job talk with an invitation to apply for a tenured job. Ji-Yoon tries to say why, then she quickly tries to take the blame for the ticking time bomb of the department. But we all know it's too late. It's Yale. Yaz says, you're acting like you owe them something. This is such an important scene. The university is a bad boyfriend. It lets you down. Yaz goes on to say, they let you be here. It's not that Ji-Yoon is brilliant or good at a job. She pre-sees some of the colonial structures of the university and its benefactors, cotton, sugar, racism and slavery. She should be running this place, but white men do. The dean, the bills of the department, the Elliots. Ji-Yoon reacts, do you think that's how I got here, by playing nice? The shit ton of work that Ji-Yoon would have had to do, one, to get tenure, two, to become the chair, is pretty astounding. Ji-Yoon says that she stayed at Pembroke for the people, like Joan, Bill and Yaz. They discuss the offer that Yaz has been given. Sounds pretty good. I don't think Pembroke can match it, neither do Yaz or Ji-Yoon. We cut to Bill sitting side by side with the elderly aunties from the party. They're at his home. Grandfather and the ladies have cleaned up and Bill is eating cake. Juju is at the piano making the shrine for Sharon. Bill gets the pizza rolls from the freezer and the olds in the other room are discussing the potential of Bill. He needs a shave. He's a drug addict and he drinks. The woman in the baby blue suit sees right through him. This is where the title of the episode comes from. One of the ladies exclaims that Ji-Yoon is turning 50 soon and maybe this, indicating Bill, is the last bus into town. As Juju is leaving, she says to Bill, she's going to find you. Bill looks as though he's going to cry. As Hubby and Juju get getting their coats, Bill asks, what does Ji-Yoon pick in her doll ceremony? A pencil, a teacher. As Ji-Yoon arrives home, she finds a trail of metal bowl offerings of food and flowers. Juju made a shrine for Ji-Yoon's mum. We see photos, Ji-Yoon's mum's graduating photo, giving a hug to Ji-Yoon. So she's coming from an academic family, I thought. Tears run down Ji-Yoon's face. Cut to the credits.
I'm not crying, you're crying.
I cried too. Short reaction from each of you. Megan?
I still hate Bill.
Oh. Sure.
Yeah, look.
Okay. At this point, I don't think we're moving from
no,
that.
No, we've got one more episode left. I'm starting to think maybe we're not going to make
it. No chance. Yeah. Anitra?
Well, I have to admit that homeless chic pill-popping Bill is a little bit less attractive. okay.
Oh, yes. And also, again, I go with the smell of vision.
Yeah, look, it can't have been good. This episode did make me cry at the end, but not because Bill's deeply unattractive. It was very emotional, I thought. It really got me at the end in the feels.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Narelle, how about you?
This episode was all about the politics of higher ed and leadership conversations that happen behind the scenes, which I thought were really revealing. And I think the complexities and insights into every relationship throughout this episode really unfolded in a really nice way. I think the vulnerability of Ji Yoon as a leader was at her best. The journey of Bill with Mr. Kim was quite powerful. The aunties and Juju were hilarious and very, very relatable. And I cried a lot in this episode, emotionally raw, particularly towards the end.
Yeah, that last scene of Ji-Yoon and him crying at the picture of her mother, I was like, yeah. Okay, how about you, Bertha?
Yeah, I'm still in the not liking Bill camp. And this episode had a little bit too much focus on Bill for my liking. But I think it's really saved by the appearance and the hilarious introduction of Dave Duchovny for this, you know, kind of X-Files and lifelong X-Files fan, I should say. Yeah, but I think, you know, for an Asian academic who is actually based in Asia, there's a lot of the scenes, especially with the aunties, but also with the kind of the politics of academia that resonated very, very much and very, very deeply in this episode.
Looking forward to unpacking that a bit more. I did love the peek into Ji-Yoon's family world, even if it was via Bill, and I did really cringe laugh at all the DD bits. But in the end, I just thought it was bittersweet, and not the least of which is that Ji-Yoon has her only victory as a chair and it immediately doesn't matter, which is academia in a nutshell, really. But let's dig a little deeper now. I think we're spoilt for choice in this one about the realistic scene and what did it accurately capture or critique about academic life. So let's start out with you, Bertha. What did you think was the most realistic scene or scenes?
I think they were, you know, obviously, like I mentioned before, there were a couple of scenes that really stood out for me. And I think June's line when she said, you know, if I were a man, would you ask me that? That, I think, probably resonated with a lot of female academics, because I think we would have, at any point in our career, would have actually asked that. And being here now, because I worked in the UK before I moved back here, so I suppose, the opportunity to sort of work from two different, very distinct cultures. And this line, when I heard it, had an extra complexity when you know, being thinking about where I am now, because if I was in the UK and I can ask that question, I can push the boundaries a little bit. And if I were to ask that, and I've done that here in Malaysia, just sort of put this question out there during meetings or whatever it is, or even in conferences in other parts of Asia, it's really complex, because things like sexism and even racism is often disguised as culture, and in particular sexism. And the conversation usually kind of derails from sort of casual sexism to me being too westernized, and therefore I'm being too confrontational, because you've spent so much time in the UK and that's where you work, and do remember that you're no longer in the UK. And that was what that scene kind of, you know, spoke to me in a sense, because whenever I try to kind of ask the sort of questions that push the boundaries a little bit, the whole thing about westernization being confrontational kind of comes up. And I think, you know, this sort of also leads me to another scene in an episode, that conversation between Yaz and Ji-Yoon about Yale, when Ji-Yoon actually said, you think I got here by being nice? And there's a lot to unpack there about this notion of, I think, the model minority that a lot of Asian academics actually had to face. And I think the scene also emphasized a lot of the assumptions that aren't just imposed on Black female scholars, that there's layers and layers of assumptions here that I think perhaps a lot of people don't really unpack. I'm just starting to unpack that myself. People like Ji-Yoon, Asian scholars in particular, face the assumption of being the model minority, that a lot of us got to where we are, or, you know, have any sort of a career by keeping quiet and being the nice one and not being particularly confrontational. So it's a lot of contradictions there, but it's also kind of layers and layers and layers of complexities. I think there's a lot of assumption that June and Yaz are kind of on the same side because they're both non-white female academics in a very white kind of setting. But there's also a lot of assumptions that Yaz made on Ji-Yoon, because a lot of times I think Ji-Yoon can pass as white in certain situations that Yaz probably can't. And I feel a lot of that, because that says a lot about my own experience as well in academia. This episode really just kind of blew my mind in all these sort of different ways.
And so amazing to be able to hear that experience of comparing being in the UK and being in Malaysia. And then, I mean, culture's used as an argument in both settings, isn't it? But it's deployed differently. Yeah, what's acceptable and what counts as confrontational? Mm-hmm, we could talk about this all day, Bertha. So fascinating. Thank you. Megan, what about you?
The work that Yaz has made to do with Elliot, that confrontation there, is quite amazing, I think, and an insight into sort of the relationships in academia, where you're beholden on a judgment from someone else to get tenure. And, you know, for me, that was very much Yaz is burning her Elliot bridge. I know that Yaz is leaving at that point, because there's no way that she would be able to stay in that situation with Elliot offside.
And maybe also starting to realise that maybe she doesn't need him, potentially.
You can see her, though, she has that moment where she walks away and she thinks, no, I'm not going to do this, and then she's like, yeah, fuck it. No, I've had enough now.
It's like that moment she's actually listening and believing her own words that she said the previous episode, when it was like, oh, great, so he's had 40 years in this career to be the leader. And she said that, but now she's like, oh, actually, I'm really questioning this.
Yeah. Mm. I like that he's in front of a microfiche reader when that happens. That was a nice little technological signifier there.
Anitra, what about you?
Oh, I just loved when she pulled off her cunning plan, Ji-Yoon. You know, how good is she? Like, solving that David Duchovny problem. She got the lectureship back. She made everyone happy. Like, even Mrs. Whitehood wouldn't know, because she just said, you just tell them you changed your mind. And, like, he's a celebrity. He's fickle. They'll buy it. I was just like, really amazing creative problem solving, stakeholder management that is demanded so often. And just that, I just felt that moment of joy when she pulled it off. And then, of course, it's too late. Like, you know, fucking Yale. Just, it's sad that it's too late. She could be so great at this. She's already great. You know, she's got that devious yet get everybody what they want kind of thing that a chair's going to need, you know.
It was Machiavellian, brilliantly Machiavellian, and then immediately.
Yeah, she could just say, she could just find a way to get everybody to get what they wanted and just, you know. Anyway, for once I didn't have to problem solve for her. I'm like, she's got this. I'll just relax. It's okay, Ji-Yoon, you can do this. So that was good.
Narelle, how about you?
It was that moment when Jazz was telling Ji-Yoon that she's agreed to deliver her lectureship at Yale, which then probably comes with leaving and everything that goes with that. And for me, that was a real big moment that, you know, good people are often screwed around and they're consistently told that they'll be offered things and that there's opportunities. But you hear it so many times, but those leaders never come back to you, or they wait too long. And so that tension between them not following up, you wondering what's going on, you know you're missing out on opportunity, you know you're not being valued, and, you know, good people go.
Yeah.
Oh, so true. Good people always have more options, don't they?
Yeah, they really do.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I thought about this scene when this week I just went for a state-sanctioned walk with a colleague, and we were having almost exactly that conversation. I thought, how long are they going to jerk her chain, you know? I particularly liked, I don't know how much you all enjoyed, Ji-Yoon's list of what's happened in the last 30 years in scholarship. And people can think, oh, English literature, it's about books, isn't it? But she says, like, effect theory, eco-criticism, digital humanities, new materialism, book history, development and gender studies, and critical race theory. And I love that list. It's real, right? Like,
Absolutely.
It's maybe pretty.
I like that she led with affect theory too, because, you know, that's my
point. I know, I was so, yeah, I stopped and rewatched that.
I just want someone to say affect theory on television. I feel so seen.
Exactly. I mean, I love the fact that when she actually listed all the things that has happened in the last 30 years, I was like, oh my God, I understand it. Like,
yes. That's right. You feel like,
kind of talk, like, what?
You're like, yep, tick, tick, tick. Yeah. I felt like a proper academic listening to that list. It doesn't happen to me very often.
And it was also like this little in-joke moment, isn't it? Just there for us. Like Mr. Thesis Whisperer is like, yeah, whatever. But I was snore laughing all the way through it. And I do really like that little moment in the car where she says to Juju, Julie fucking noted about Ava going to Disneyland. Juju's doing the little shit. And I got really mad at the bullshit from Elliot about how if he doesn't criticise her, they're not going to believe him, because clearly female scholars and scholars of colours need to be criticised. There's research on this, and it shows that male academics do give other male academics better reference letters.
Wow.
And it just really does it made me so mad. I remember like a female philosopher once saying to me, they get to set the topics that you're allowed to study, you know, and if you study the other topics, then they're not as rigorous or not as interesting. And they'll say things on reference letters like, oh, well, even though she does affect theory,
hey,
she seems to be a good teacher, you know.
Hey, you leave affect theory alone, okay?
Yeah, leave it alone.
Leave Britney alone.
Our affect theory. We need a T-shirt with that on. Okay, now I want us to move on to unpicking the most unrealistic details or scenes. And I'm also interested, do you wish it was true? So, Megan, we'll start with you.
I still can't believe how much of a dick Bill is in this episode. How does he keep his job? That's what I want to know.
Well, he doesn't, though. I mean.
But, you know, it's taken a year to get to this point. It would take us 3 weeks to get to this point. If we did this,
three
we'd
weeks?
Be out on an ear.
That's been generous. 3 weeks.
Okay, Nietzsche, what about you?
I think that the first stages of an academic coup are usually done one-to-one, not in a group. So people won't say stage a coup. I mean, there'd be lots of like, well, we need to do this for the sake of the department. Usually revolution starts with an email, and it's usually got a table in it, in my experience. That's next level. Academic Game of Thrones shit going on there. There's a table.
Spreadsheet.
It is on.
Spreadsheets of 10
That's
pages.
Right.
Yeah. And a How about you, reel. Bertha?
There's a lot of things to which are probably a little bit too realistic for me for this particular episode, but I think Joan, when she was lamenting about how you don't really age out of academia, and I think, you know, certain parts of the world, this goes back to what I was talking about earlier about cultural context. I think certain parts in the world, you do age out of academia, and we're seeing a lot of that now in America and even in the UK. But some countries in Asia and institutions in Asia, people don't age out. Kind of cultural norms takes precedence over growth. Or progress. Being kind of the young academic joining a school or a faculty that's been around and filled with kind of people who are much older than me, there's a lot of all these sort of, oh, you know, what do you know? You know, you should be calling me, even though we all have PhDs and we are considered peers in academia, I've been there where I'm at an age where you should really be calling me auntie because I'm your mom's age. I'm like, fuck this. This is academia.
You know,
it's like, why would I want to call you auntie? Because we are in a professional setting. So I think that moment was like, it's unrealistic, but it's also realistic at the same time. It really depends. And again, it comes from kind of having worked in two very different disparate cultures in that sense. I don't think it necessarily translates everywhere. You know, I don't know whether that sort of makes sense, but that was sort of how I feel. It's very conflicting when I was watching that scene.
How about you, Narelle?
I'll agree with Anitra, and it's most unrealistic is the beginning of the academic coup and how that all unravels.
Okay, so I actually had trouble finding an unrealistic scene again in this episode, but the dean and the comms guy then co-opting that undergraduate complaint. and then saying, oh, she shouldn't have to complain, and then agreeing with each other and nodding sanctimoniously about it. And it really annoyed me the convenient way they believe the victim when they want to. And I've actually never encountered this in practice, but I have certainly encountered situations where a minor complaint has been hyped up to get rid of someone. Usually that happens when there's a big history, a long history of many complaints adding up, and then there'll be the one that the straw that sort of broke the camel's back. It's like the 20th or 50th complaint. And I think this idea of a hyped up sexual misconduct charge really feeds into a male fear. I don't know what you all think of that. Like men being afraid of being accused of sexual harassment, a la Christian Porter.
Ugh.
No one wants to buy into that one.
I went to art school. I can't say anything.
You don't want to incriminate yourself, like put yourself up for a defamation or slander accusation.
I went to art school in the 80s.
I think you're right, though. There is a lot of fear out there that they will get unfairly, in quote marks. And that's that thing that, I mean, Christian Porter trades on, right? Like the idea that they're just a bloke, they made a mistake, you know, and that women are sort of supposed to forgive that. I don't know. I don't know where to go with that.
Yes. I suppose this one just really annoyed me because it's like, oh, yes, well, she shouldn't have to complain. Like, we both.
I love the little nod that they did at each other. Like, he looked at him and then he nodded like, yes, that's right. And then he was like, I got it right. And then they continued on. That was kind of a nice little look.
I think that's what I was responding to, is this the way that, like, you've learned some sort of script that you don't actually really believe it, or, you know, you're not actually really trying to help. Anyway, that's what annoyed me, but it wasn't necessarily unrealistic. All right, team, for you, what was the funniest scene or perhaps the most touching moment and why? Megan, you first.
I love the party scene with the aunties talking about Ji-Yoon's old boyfriend and the auntie saying, I'm making him a jumper to get through the winters.
Yeah, doesn't her dad, like, send him steaks or something? Like, wasn't there some other?
Something like that.
Oh, poor Ji-Yoon. Just no. when your family has liked the boyfriend and he's gone. That's a tough one.
I think there was a tweet at one point when the chair first came out and somebody had actually seen. I noticed that. I don't know whether, you know, Daniel Dae Kim actually posed as Yoon's old boyfriend. And there was a tweet that said, who can stand against Daniel Dae Kim?
That's true.
I was like, oh, my God, yeah, completely.
He's a very handsome man. How about you, Bertha?
Well, obviously, being the X-Files nerd here, Duchovny's introduction. And I thought, you know, it was a really nice throwback to the now infamous scene from the X-Files. It was a season 2 episode called Duaneberry. And I looked it up in case I forgot and I got the episode wrong. It's not. With the red Speedos, it broke the internet when it first came out in the 90s. And that was the exact same scene with the exact same. I don't know whether it's the exact same Speedos, but it was just kind of that nice little kind of throwback there. And I had no idea. When I saw that, I think as soon as she walked in and I saw the pool, I was like, oh my God, they're not going to go there. And then when he came out of the pool, I was like, they went there. So that was a really nice introduction. And I thought a kind of a nice little in-joke as well. Amanda Peet was actually one of the... She was in one of the films, the X-Files films. There were two X-Files films. She was actually in the second one. So I thought that was a nice little, probably, and they had a friendship out of that, Duchovny. I mean, the cast and Amanda Peet. So that was probably why that kind of cameo happened. Because, as I said, I think I mentioned last week, I still keep in touch with the fans because it was such a huge part of my PhD thesis. And I still keep in touch with a lot of them. No one knew about this cameo. And I was trying to find out from everyone. They're like, what? No, where? So that was a nice kind of nod there, I thought. And Duchovny was called the thinking woman's heartthrob.
I do remember that.
Yeah, because when The X-Files came out, I think it was one of the shows that actually showed kind of there's a woman who's a scientist, and it was probably one of, you know, the first of its kind. And they were both such kind of nerds in a way. And So he was kind of the thinking woman's heartthrobe at the height of that X-Files popularity. So I thought it was nice in that sense as a nod to all that sort of X-Files in joke there. A touching scene in a sort of a very roundabout way, I think, when our Korean aunties were talking about Ji-Yoon being single and this idea of singledom and how she's nearing 50 is such a taboo in a lot of Asian communities, and I wish the show dealt a bit more into that. I don't know whether they're getting a second season where they can actually explore that, because I can't imagine that, you know, just listening to the way that they spoke about her, that there must have been a lot of pressure to kind of make her kind of disdriven, this sort of, and I think that was, I didn't even notice, I think, was it Megan who kind of mentioned that there was a photo of her mom, and potentially she comes from an academic family as well. I didn't even notice that. But I think there has to be a lot of external pressures. It sounds like there's a lot of external pressures. And I wish they'd gone a little bit into that, because I think kind of watching it as an Asian academic, I could feel, I could sense that. I've heard a lot of all these sort of stories and all these pressures coming from other sort of, not just academics, but sort of Asian professionals, professional women, in that sense, having that external pressure. And also being too driven, too smart, too headstrong, too American, too westernized. So totally there.
And the disciplining that by other older women, that I think that's a bit intercultural, but I think there's absolutely no, the aunties don't even try and hide that it's okay to talk about Ji-Yoon like that to each other, whereas I think in Australian whitey Anglo culture, it would be a little bit more covert and a bit more suggestive. Like Anitra and I share, don't we? Shall we say a relative who would fit in this category?
I'm with Narelle. We maybe don't want to put that into the podcast.
Yeah, the passive aggressive older woman. Yeah, but I sort of, the way that the two of them, it's just obviously such an accepted form of conversation, and it's deployed not only on Ji-Yoon but probably many other women in their community. That you really got a sense of that being such a well-worn repertoire. Yeah, Anitra. How about you?
I just have to say thank you to Bertha for reminding me of that pool scene so I could Google it, because I'd forgotten all about it. It's really quite something. It's a scene. Yeah. You should Google it. That's all I'm going to say. Anyway, I like the Korean aunties too, especially when they were back at Bill's house and one of them starting to fall into, you know, the Narelle and Anitra Inga side of the Bill equation and starting to go, oh, Bill, he's quite cute. And the other one's like firmly on the Megan side of it, where she's just like, do not fall into that fan club. She's got such a look of horror on her face. Like, why would she want a drug addict? And I was like, you know what? The aunties are right. You really should listen to them, Ji-Yoon. And yeah, and the bit at the end, that with Juju making that for Ji-Yoon's mother, which is out of character for Juju, but like, you know, Juju's going to be okay. She's going to be fine. That she could do something like that for her mother is lovely. And it was all the feels. I loved it. So that was very touching, I thought.
Mm. Yeah. How about you, Narelle?
Yeah, I agree with Anitra that very end, that is such a touching scene, and Juju and Bill at the piano and her letter to Sharon, you know, now you can come home, cue the tears. Mm. And then Bill's question to Ji-Yoon's father about what did she select for her doll ceremony. And, you know, that I reckon that was one of the most adult conversations you see him have, at least for a little while, you know, throughout this series, and the thinking that came through that.
You're good at spotting these moments for us, Narelle. Like, I think there's been two where he hasn't been a man-child.
Yeah.
You see what he could be if he wasn't such a hot mess.
His potential.
I did, yeah. Potential boyfriend material. What did you all think of that moment where the aunties are sort of, one of the aunties is in the Bill's fan club, I think I remember this, and then Arpy says something like, I keep my house clean, and they just look at him.
Yeah, like he's a widow. I'm a widow. I keep my house clean. They're just like,
Just give him no. And he just looks like, oh, yeah, I never get any credit for that. Like, I deal with myself anyway. I did like that scene where old Elliot and old John, and then John finding out about the list, and Elliot complaining, we're still in our intellectual prime and have plenty to offer, and then John farts and then says, was that you or me? And that little barb also about James Franco to David Duchovny, I could have unpacked that scene forever, but, you know, well, he actually got his PhD from Yale, you know, and that all but dissertation shame that's very common in America. Like, it's very common in America to do the qualifying exams, start the thesis dissertation part and just not ever finish it. It's actually called ABD, so all but dissertation. Mm. And it's almost an honourable state, because to even pass the exam shows that you're probably capable of it and you just sort of haven't got round to it, the all but dissertation. So, you know, you can sort of trade on that. I'm enrolled, I just haven't done my dissertation, I'm good enough for it, I just haven't got round to it type of thing. So,
and then anyway, you can just I like let it sleep for 30 years.
Yeah, so you can just let it sit
write there. Write four books.
But, hey, Melbourne Uni will still let you do that. You can let yourself lapse and you just pay a fee, come back and hand the thing in. They'll embrace it. What is with all these actors getting publishing contracts? Anyway, moving on. We could be bitter.
And I've worked in publishing. Publishing's, it's not easy, wasn't easy before the internet came along and ruined everything. It's really not easy now. They've already got, you know, they've got an audience. Of course you're going to get
them. Yeah, I suppose you want to sell books.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay, team, best lines and why? Megan.
Yes, announcing to Ji-Yoon her Yale news, and Ji-Yoon knows that she can't just match that offer that Yaz is going to get. It's a sure thing.
Mm.
And Yaz knows
is that where she goes, fucking Yale? Fucking Yale.
Yeah, fucking Yale.
How about you, Anitra?
I thought Korean ear muscles was funny and I shouldn't laugh, but I did. I did laugh. It's kind of a nice little bit of male bonding in a really kind of not very
toxic,
yeah, in a not very good way, yeah. But you know.
Okay, how about you, Bertha?
I've got lines, probably not kind of shocking or surprising, is when Ji-Yoon said, you think that's how I got here, by playing nice? Is that how you think I fucking got here? I was like, oh my God, that is me all the time. And to me, that, you know, pretty much sums up the assumptions about Asian scholars and a whole kind of model minority myth, because it's something that I'm still fighting against, even though I'm working in Asia, because it's really odd. I just realized now how a lot of Asian scholars, female scholars in particular, have sort of embraced that model minority myth, even though in Asia, it's the same thing. Like, a lot of people assumed that I got to where I am just by sitting there and waiting for things to fall in my lap, and I'm still dealing with this every day. I was like, oh my God, I wish I can say that. Is that how you think I fucking got here? So yeah, that line, those lines were just like, yes.
Well, you just want to be heard and believed, don't you? To be able to say that, and be heard and believed would be amazing, right? Like, and validating, yeah. And you've really got me thinking about this model minority thing, Bertha, and I do wonder too, like, back in the day when women started to enter academia, whether the white women that entered academia became the sort of model minority, and that might explain why some women who are, like, more advanced in age are not allies in academia, because they've been the sort of model minority for the men and they've taken on those masculinist kind of ways of operating and behaviours, and they're sort of they're passing as men. And I've really felt that with older female colleagues. Does anyone else want to have a career limiting move and talk about that at all? Or have I dropped another dead cat on the table?
Actually, I didn't mean that. Sorry, Narelle.
My first year in tenure, for a better word, you know, moving out of sessional to tenure, sitting in a work plan meeting, and I remember a senior academic saying to me, I had to do it hard, so should you. I'm not helping you.
Oh, wow.
And that was a mentality that you really did see and experience. And, you know, I think I spent most of my time at that institution in tears, primarily with that person, and I'm happy for this to go to air because I've written about it, so it's okay. Wow. But, you know, who says that to people?
That's horrible. You know, once
that's pretty
horrible.
Blatant.
You know, look,
it's
it goes blatant. Outside of academia too, because once I was walking down the street with my friend Angie, and we both had our strollers with our kids. We were just having a chat, a cup of coffee, and this woman stopped us, like stood in front of the prams and just looked at us and said, "Your husbands help you so much. We had to do it so hard. You don't know how easy you've got it." And then she just walked off, and I was just like, who says that to two ladies walking their prams down the street? Like,
how bitter
do you have to be of, like,
yeah.
You know? That's just horrible. I can't believe they said that to you. What did you even say? Did you just look at them and kind of go, "I don't know what to say to you"? Or, like...
Yeah, I think it's taken like 15 years of processing of what I would really like to say to that person now. But at the time, I was like, my goodness, I'm a good girl. I'm a high achiever. Really? Like, you
this
know,
is not how we play.
I've never had anybody speak to me in such a way that was like, oh, you don't help people? What?
Yeah.
Like, what's that? I'm not. Yeah, I suppose it was the first of realizing this is what we do in academia, or what some people do in academia.
Well, it also feels like whatever you do isn't enough. You can have an older academic say to you, "I'm not going to help you because I didn't have anyone helping me, and therefore you should do it by yourself." But then when you actually try, or you feel like you're doing, it is just never enough. It doesn't feel like it's never enough. So it ends up being you're either a threat to that person, or you just, you know, you end up being in the cycle of, oh, I'm never good enough. I had that when I was doing my PhD, actually. I moved institutions when I was doing PhD, and this was a big name feminist scholar, which made it worse because you're thinking, oh my God, you are, you know, one of the biggest names, biggest sort of feminist scholar out there in the world, and you're saying this to me. So it must make me a really bad academic, you know, and then to say that to a PhD student was devastating. I ended up switching institutions at the end of the day and had a much better experience with the PhD experience, but hearing about other people's experience with that particular academic and realizing, oh, it's not me, you know, it's her, it's that other person who has the problem. But it took years and years of just trying to get on top and over that kind of, you know, you not being good enough. And when you're an Asian, it just makes it worse. It's just kind of like, oh, I'm not good enough because, you know, I'm not local, I'm not white, I'm Asian, I should be doing something else, not sort of cultural studies or you know, the path not taken in that sense. It's horrifying to be that kind of. Yeah.
Well, not all women are sisters, right? I mean...
Yeah. My friend Mary Helen has a really great term to capture this, I think. You know how some people are described as culturally Catholic because they go to church at Easter and Christmas, or you're culturally Jewish and you go to synagogue, you know, at holidays as well. She says that there's a class of women that are cultural feminists. It's like they have all the feminist trappings. They maybe write feminist literature. They talk big game, but the lateral violence and the kind of microaggressions that they perpetuate show that they're not living their values. And so I've got a label whenever I see it. I think, cultural feminist. And I never quite know what to do with these people. Like, I actually find them really scary, I have to say. Because they're good at it. I quite often say, you know, if a man's got it in for you in academia, you can kind of see the moves coming. It's like a clumsy kind of karate movie, and you're like, oh yeah, that's true. That one. Mm. You're kind of like Neo in the Matrix, like, oh yeah, bullet went over the top of me. But you know, if a woman has it in for you, you are in deep shit because they're good. They have to be good, right? Like at the same time, I kind of see it as I try and forgive it as a trauma response, but at the same time, I can't forgive it. At the same time, it's the essence of conflicted. Megan, did you want to weigh in? Since
as the precarious staff member of the group, no, thank you.
No, okay.
I have to say, also, you know, I've worked with a pretty amazing, kick-ass older woman academic who I still love and respect, and watched her give a helping hand up to lots of other people too. So those people are definitely out there, and we should be celebrating and appreciating them. That means a lot.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Totally. Oh, yes. Totally. Yeah.
There's absolute magnificent women out there who are just wonderful mentors on every level and actually call out some of this this behavior.
And are unafraid, and still, you know.
Yeah.
And you need that.
And they're the ones who've helped, they're the ones who've helped me deal with it. Yeah. They're the ones I go to and say, this is happening. I can't, I feel so betrayed. I feel so traumatized by this.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that help you through. So,
I kind of felt a bit disappointed about Joan because I thought she was that person. You know, she doesn't show, she's not doing the right thing here, participating in that particular coup, I think.
100%. And I think that's why Joan sort of raises questions for us. When I first thought of this podcast title that we were talking about doing a podcast for a while, Megan and Narelle and I, but the first time I was going to call it Friends of Joan, and then by season, by episode four, I was like, nope. we would be friends of Joan, but Joan would probably have disappointed us greatly at this point in time. Narelle, where are you?
Well, I guess it's timely in terms of the best one-liners, in terms of Joan on the couch and when she says, a lifetime of this and I get nothing. And it's that real critical moment of realising what's happening for her. It speaks so much to the overwork culture in academia, the system of shifting goalposts. Time flies in academia. Sometimes you get caught up in your own little thing and then you realise everything's moving around you. It talks so much to expectations, assumptions, and the realization that when you give so much, but what is it they actually get back? And when those penny drops, and I've seen it with so many colleagues. I've had moments of it myself when you have to really step back and reflect, and I think she just wraps it all up in this old woman sitting on the couch in her tan, washed out appearance, and she's getting angry about, you know, what's going on for her.
In fact, I think I said 13 years of this and I get nothing when I left my last job, honestly.
I think I said that when I left RMIT, 15 years of this and I get nothing.
You know, but the best revenge is living a nice life, is moving on and doing something else. But Joan's run out of runway, right? She doesn't have that option.
Or for those listening and they're just starting out or they're, 5 years, 10 years into it, actually we now have the power to sit back and go, actually, what am I getting out of this? And carving that out for you in amongst, figuring out how to play the game and stuff like that. And there's a lot of us having those conversations about if we're going to stay in academia, what is it that we're getting out of it? How are we being connected with our meaning and purpose? But also, how do we help others in whatever field, whatever area that is? And I like that those conversations are starting to happen.
I love you, Narelle. You know that, right?
I love you too, Inga. Thank you.
My favourite line was, what promotion ever means you don't have to work as much? Lol. G into her dad who's annoyed that she won't go to the party. And I have to read this whole line from David Duchovny. I don't see colour or ethnicity or even faces at this point. I just see a vibe, an aura, and yours is lovely. And then I think the best bit was the way that he drops a sigh at the end, like there's a pause and then he's so happy with it. I don't know what the sigh was. And then the stare from Ji-Yoon, only Sandra Oh can do those stares. And I just sort of cringe laughed through that whole bit. It's just hilarious.
Add on to this, though. This isn't the first time David Duchovny has done parodies of himself. If you Google the Larry Sanders Show and Dave Duchovny, he does like a over-the-top kind of almost similar over-the-top, but, this was back in the 90s when he was kind of Fox Mulder. And he did the exact same thing. He played like a kind of asshole parodied version of himself and reenacting scenes from, I believe it was Basic Instinct, the Sharon film. Google it. I think that exchange Strange was another thing that when I was looking at it, you know, watching it, it's like, oh my god, it's taking me back to all these sort of David Duchovny moments. Like, so yeah, there's that.
You do have to love it. You do have to love an old white guy who can take the piss out of himself, though. I mean, it's that movie on Netflix, Always Be My Maybe. Have you seen that one? It's, yeah, it's set in San Francisco.
Oh, and with Keanu Reeves does that.
Yeah, yeah, Keanu Reeves does a parody of himself as well. Yes. So good. Okay, let's move on now. We need to pull this bus off the freeway down into the depot. The most important segment, I think you'll agree, colleagues, costumes. Your favourite and why, Megan?
I really like the auntie sitting on the couch, one auntie in the baby blue suit, but my special favourite was the black ensemble of the auntie who didn't like Bill either.
And the hair was great too.
The hair was good, like, yeah.
On point.
They're very styly aunties, yeah, absolutely. Anitra, how about you?
I like the tan corduroy blazer jacket over that lovely white sweater that Ji-Yoon wears, which was, again, another all-day outfit. You know, I mean, she was planning on making it to the one-year-old's birthday party, would have worked there. She goes to meet a celebrity and catches him in the swimming pool. Outfit works. You know, she's like,
she's a master.
Getting called on the couch for, you know, for her work. And that gold necklace, it really shouldn't work. That sort of thick gold necklace that she was wearing over the top of the white sweater. Mm. Anyway, lovely.
She does do a good necklace over brown.
Yeah, she really does. Yeah.
Like, you do have to appreciate that. Bertha, how about you?
Same thing as Anitra, the kind of the off white. It looked like cashmere.
Oh, it did.
It looked so comfortable. It looked so soft. And I just love it. And yeah, and the whole thing was that, you know, Duchovny's house, what more can I ask for? So.
I love Gigi's little corduroy overall dress. I wish I had a daughter so I could afford that dress. I did buy corduroy overalls for Thesis Whisperer Jr. back in the day when I could dress him. It was fantastic. And the peach-coloured skivvy with it is perfection. But also Minji, the baby. I love an overdressed baby so much, you know, like a baby that's like that one dress they'll wear once and probably vomit on or shit on or something. Yeah. But you've got that photo of them in the overdressed baby. It's just the best.
It's like when I used to dress my boys in little suits to go and see the Nutcracker at Christmas time and I would just be like, yeah. I don't care. You're going to wear a little suit, little suit jacket with a little shirt.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to wear it once a year and I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Like it's like a living doll. It's your living doll moment. Yeah. And they very rarely give you any of that. So, you know. How about you, Narelle?
I love Gigi's corduroy with the skivvy outfit as well. That was all thing. It actually reminded me of my childhood. We had little pink skivvies. My sister and I had matching little baby pink skivvies.
<It's horrible. laughs>
I know. It might, yeah. And Yaz's hooped earrings. Love them.
Yeah,
very, like, with her curls and her rolled neck and just the hoops are just spot on. Ji-Yoon's dad's suit, suave, really suave. And Ji-Yoon's chain over her white top as well. I wish I could carry something like that off.
No, that's it, right? Like, how does she do that? Because that really shouldn't work. Mm. It should look very mumsy and not very cool, but... Yeah.
Only Sandra Oh can do that. Okay. So that's all our opinions, thoughts and feelings. But what about you? This is our correspondence section where we read out our feedback on the episode or on the pod. And you can still send us some email if you want to the email address in the show notes. Who would like to read out the first one? Any volunteers? This is from the Apple Podcasts. It's an evaluation. It's got some critical feedback in it. How about you, Megan? Megan, do you want to do it?
Sure. It's called Fantastic, but could do without ... Five stars, though.
Five stars, yeah, that's good.
Five stars. I'm thoroughly enjoying your new podcast. I love the banter and the analysis by a bunch of academics like myself. However, I feel like fast-forwarding the recap, it's too long, and I've already seen the ep. I want to hear you, wonderful bunch of women, talk about it. And, like, I know that we're wonderful.
And look,
Look, we've heard this before. We read the evals.
It's fair criticism, point. Yeah. But we also don't mind if you use the fast forward. We will never know.
That's right. It's a victimless crime.
And maybe it is a victimless crime, and maybe I'll go back and I'll put chapter marks so that people can do that. And
then
they
can cool.
see how they want to.
We read the emails.
Because we do actually have other listeners who haven't seen the show at all and have only listened to us talk about it and love the recap. So some people are actually listening to it only because they don't want to actually watch the show, so they listen to it for the recap so they know what people are talking about. So, look, we can cater to both audiences, correct?
Right. We are we salesmen and we do pander to our students? Is that what we're doing?
We pander.
Yeah, we pander. We'll pander. Mm-hmm.
You tell us, we'll pander. Narelle, would you like to read the next one, which is also a 5-star review? Thank you for. We've only got 5-star reviews. Mind you, we only have 10 of them, but we only have 5-star reviews. We appreciate all of you. Narelle, do you want to read this one out?
This one's titled Enjoyable. Academics are indeed divided on this. I enjoyed the commentary on the first episode.
Which made me wonder, only the first episode? Have you gone on to listen to more episodes? I have to tell you, team, that there is a lot more listens of the first episodes, but I'm being optimistic and thinking people are just saving it up. They'll listen to it when they get to it.
Well, yes. They're just finding us now, so it's just like, we're nearly on to episode 6. They're just like, oh, hello, didn't know you guys existed.
And it does take longer to listen to us than to watch the actual episode, which has been pointed out a few times. Hey, so, okay, people are busy.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or maybe it's just right. Binge true.
Yeah, that's true. We can binge. We're built for binging. I want to thank my colleague Victoria Firth-Smith at BFSES on Twitter, who pointed out to me that we've had many students at ANU graduate with cloaks and capes and sent me a story. So I've just not been privileged enough to sit on the stage and witness that, but hopefully next time. And Megan, you shared an amazing one. Yes, and that's your colleague, Tariki Onus.
Tariki Onus, yep. And this is he's wearing a possum skin cloak, which he's made. And it's one of the cloaks that we also use at the Willen Centre. And it's a beautiful thing.
Does anyone want to read the tweet reply to that thread from Just Me?
I'll do it if you like.
Yeah, sure.
Love your podcast sometimes more than the episode, winky face.
We'll take that action. Thank you, Just Me.
I had a different take on Bill's apology for Juju. I thought he kidded you. Bite me as an insult and she taking it as an invitation. That totally makes sense.
That's a good interpretation, I thought, of Juju.
Somewhat kind of tracks with Juju's personality.
Yeah.
It really does, doesn't it? Yeah. You take it all a bit literally. And thank you to Dr. Rebecca Sutherland, who is pointing out that our podcast is a really good one for walking.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I've had that from quite a few people. So we're happy to be in your ears for your walk, especially because there's so much walking going on in Victoria, ACT and New South Wales at the moment. Because what else the hell can we do, people?
I definitely do have walking podcasts and cooking podcasts now I think about it. And then housework podcasts.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Mm. And to Dr. Joanna Tai, who said that we're drawing her attention to all the things that she missed when she watched it and that we're making her think more deeply about what stuff means. Mm-hmm. Our work here is done, really, people. It is nearly done. This is the second last episode. Thank you for listening. Like we said, we're 4 white female academics in Australia and 1 woman of colour in Malaysia, Asia scholar Bertha Chin. Thanks for being with us, Bertha. It's been amazing. Really appreciate you being here. These are our reactions. You can email us on the address in the show notes. You can leave a review on the Apple Podcast, and as you see, we'll read them out. And you can rate us and make the pod easier to find. If you want to join us actually in voice, no one's taken up this invitation yet, but, you know, maybe, speakbypipe.com/thesiswhisperer. We'll put the link in the show notes too. Where can people find you on the internet, Megan?
I'm at Megan J. McPherson on Insta and Twitter, where you'll meet my academic cats, Maximum, Dulcie and Mr. Finn.
Who have been sneaking around during this episode.
They've been very active.
Cat tail.
Well, and I've had to have the treats.
I didn't see them. They were off screen. Fantastic. Cat wrangling. Yeah. Multitasking. How about you, Narelle? Where can people find you?
You can find me as Rally Pops on Twitter. And then on Instagram, I've got two accounts, Rally Pops and Explore and Create Co. And you can also find me at exploreandcreateco.com.
Where you'll find amazing downloadable worksheets, by the way. Mm. I had reason to send someone to your downloadable worksheets the other day, Narelle, and they are both useful and beautiful. Thank you for that
lovely
service
Thank
that you offer. Anitra, where can people find you?
I'm Anitra Knott on all of the things, especially Pinterest. Just saying.
And how can people find your new pod? What should they do? Where should they follow you on Instagram?
At the Type Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And
Thank you.
I did that logo in half an hour. All right, or Jason's idea, but he explained it to me, and then I did it in half an hour just from him telling me what he wanted, and it was exactly what he said, like expertise. It's a thing. Anyway.
you and Jason are going to make a beautiful podcast, and I'm happy to be your producer.
Thanks for the plug.
And whip you into shape. Yeah. And Bertha, where can people find you? And do you have anything to plug? You know, please feel free.
Yeah, well, I'm Bertha_C on Twitter and Transcultural Fangle on Instagram. What should I plug? Well, you know, a lot of the things that I'm talking about today will show up in the chapter I wrote for Narelle's book that is coming out this year, I think, or next year.
Yeah, it is. With Rutledge, we've got a beautiful series on well-being and self-care in higher education. Mm-hmm. And book one and book two are right at the proof stage right now, and Bertha has an ace chapter.
Excellent. Well, stay tuned for that. We'll pop some sort of link. Can we do that? Some
we can.
Sort of forwarding? Yeah, fantastic.
You can pre-buy already. They're due out in November. So,
goodness.
Oh, pre-buy.
I know. Ooh.
Smash that pre-buy button. Okay. Thank you, everyone. I'm at Thesis Whisperer on Twitter. You can Google Thesis Whisperer. You find me everywhere. Thank you, friends, for being here and making lockdown just that bit more bearable. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week for our last episode. Bye.